to the Watch What Tells and podcast. I'm Nick Campbell.
I'm Matt Owens.
We have Noel Kirkpatrick.
Hello.
Cam Petruska.
Hello.
And we're here to tell you about some television that we've watched or not watched, or television that we have gained through osmosis through Twitter. Let's just kind of jump into it real quick. Start talking about some shows that we watched earlier this week. Like we did last week, let's start off with Walking Dead. What did you guys think of this week's?
Well, first, I just want to say I was right. The ratings for the third episode went up from the second episode, and I'm going to chalk it entirely up to the fact that people told their friends that there was zombie craziness, and then everyone was disappointed that there was only one zombie eating a deer in the third episode.
I mean, I liked it a lot better than last week's.
Really?
I did.
Why?
I liked it a lot. I thought it was more balanced. I wish there was a little more zombie killing in it.
Yes.
But
there's no pleasing you.
There is no pleasing me.
So too much zombies. This week, not enough.
Not enough, exactly. That's all I want is the balance. I really like the zombie killing, the big zombie killing where they all ganged up and killed them. I thought that was really well done. I think that it speaks a lot for that series of what it can accomplish. But I wish that when they were running and gunning in Atlanta that there were more zombies to kill.
Well, I think that's what we'll get tonight.
Yeah, I think so too. I think they're working out that balance, and I'm looking forward to it.
Now, how do you all feel as men that the presentation of men so far has been perhaps lacking?
We have
our adulterer. We now have our wife and perhaps child abuser. We have two angry racists. Really, when we start counting them off, we've got some problematic male characters here.
I didn't even initially look at it as male problems. I looked at it specifically as Southern problems. That's the way that I looked at it at first. I didn't think, oh, man, this is saying a lot of bad things about men. I thought this is saying really terrible things about people that are from the South.
I mean, it's got gender role problems in general anyway. I mean, the women do all the work, too. It's just bad news all around for the South, for Atlanta in general. I mean, all the characters have to be, adulterers or child abusers or mm-hmm. whatever.
Well, yeah, because it didn't make any sense to me that the women were just going along with the, we'll just clean everything. And, well, here, I'll iron your clothes. Didn't she have an iron in her hand? Is there electricity? I didn't understand that part.
There's a generator. I know that they were talking about a generator before.
And they use it for an iron?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Use it for anything.
Right. Shorts are really, really important during a zombie apocalypse.
You don't use it for the vibrators. You don't get batteries for vibrators because that's all they talk about.
Nope. Batteries, which should be much easier to find than electricity through your one generator.
Very true.
It is true. But yeah, I was happy with the episode. How did everybody else feel about the episode?
I thought the reunion with the son was very moving. Mm-hmm. I was happy with that. Again, with the wife, it's like, oh, you're back. And even though we kind of hated each other at the time, let's have sex.
And he won't wake up.
I guess that's his reward for surviving. I they didn't have any real conversation about the past. They just kind of said, oh, we're starting over. Here we go. And great.
It's true. And then, immediately, as soon as he comes back, it's like, I have to go back to Atlanta. We have to go back.
Yes, look at that. We're about 8 minutes in. First Lost reference, and it wasn't me this time.
I was going to go the whole thing, too, and have him grow a beard and everything. Mm-hmm. We have to go back. I thought that the reunion was moving, too. I thought that I really liked Daryl. Is it that name, Daryl? Merle's brother?
Yeah.
You want me to know their names? Okay.
we're not that far in. It's still too early for everyone.
But Merle's brother. I thought that was really cool. I thought that him as a hunter and everything, and the crossbow I think is an ingenious weapon.
Awesome. Yeah.
Very awesome.
Yeah. I think that it's moving in a good direction. I like it. I mean, I said a lot of bad things about it last week, but I mean, even then, I still had faith that it would kind of clean it up. It's just that last week's episode was kind of disappointing. That's all.
If we can go back to Lost for a second, though.
Yes we can.
One of the things that I loved when that show first started, and it didn't end up being fully about this, but it was just something I thought was interesting and continue to think is interesting, is what happens when you have to rebuild civilization. So whenever we have these kind of apocalyptic storylines, that's something that I just happen to find interesting. And what this show seems to be doing is actually everyone is forming their own little groups. And they're currently living side by side, but not really together. Mm-hmm. Like, the cars, like the big, you know, trailer home still belongs to the two people. It's not like they're offering to share that with everyone. They're having to barter and exchange. And they sort of help each other, but not really. And it's kind of interesting to me that this show is very much about how divisions remain firmly in place. And, you know, that could be interesting. But it's just not what I expected.
Do you think that Rick's going to come out being doing the live together, die alone speech?
Perhaps. I don't know. That's going to be my interest is, you know, are they going to have to separate because they find that there are people that you really just can't have part of a community? Or is that going to be the lesson? The lesson is we do actually have to stay together. So,
I do know that in the graphic novel, I mean, they eventually leave the camp and go, I think, to southern Georgia, and they run into another community that's significantly different than what they've been doing there. I don't want to spoil it for folks.
Okay.
Well, they need to get out of Marietta or wherever they're at, or Druid Hills or wherever they are, where they can still see the skyline from the distance.
Right.
They kind of need to get away from the city so that zombies don't climb up the hill.
Well, it's kind of also interesting, too, that there's no plan. So, I mean, the reason they have to go back for the racist dude is because there's nothing else for the show to do right now, it seems like. I mean, because they're just going to hang out there until the zombies make them move, which
isn't... That is true, yeah.
It's not terribly proactive. So no one else seems to be leading in any kind of particular way. So I don't know. It's just kind of – it's only 6 episodes, so you can only do so much. So it looks like they're pretty much going to all just get back together and have a group or whatever. But
I think it may end up that they do this little Atlanta sojourn again, and then they'll depart from the camp. I mean, they've only – so we'll see how it plays out. But I think – I imagine that they'll probably end up leaving with the season finale.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
And we'll have the new storyline for all of next season. Yeah.
Right.
Good. So they'll end with a plan. It's interesting. 6 episodes in search of a plan. It's kind of a novel way. And that's the other thing. You know, when you talk about balance, what we're going to get is a bunch of little one-offs each episode. Mm-hmm. We'll have some little problem that they have to resolve. They will resolve it by the end. But we won't actually have any kind of coherent whole that we're going to actually follow as a narrative, you know, larger than the characters until season 2.
I think it's also, I mean, even with, like, long-running series, I mean, you still normally, like, something like Lost, I mean, you still need 6 episodes to map out everyone.
Yeah. Sure.
So I think that's basically what we're dealing with is that shortened season, that really shortened season where we're experiencing all the exposition as a single season, basically. And then we get whatever happens next, basically. It's a short story as opposed to even a novella, if you just want to think of a 13-episode order as a novella as opposed to a novel.
Well, I guess, though, what I'm saying is, you know, going back to our conversation about character and how important is developing character to this show, if it's a novella, then I guess what I would maybe expect from 6 episodes is a really tight focus on the man and his family. Like, that would be something I would expect to see them resolve in the first 6 episodes. And we would meet other characters, but it would still be through the lens of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And that way I could really get into them and have real investment in them. So I certainly, you know, get part of the problem that we talked about last week is it's still too broad, perhaps, and so we aren't able to really stake a claim on this show. I mean, I'm enjoying the show. I'm certainly, you know, I'm going to stick with it and everything, but I have been thinking about what you guys said last week, and I think there's some real validity to what you said.
Well, thanks. So, yeah, Walking Dead, I feel like that it's going to only get stronger. I'm hoping that it gets stronger. And I really like that kind of Lost post-apocalyptic rebuilding kind of thing, too. That's really cool. I mean, that kind of whatever happens.
It has tons of potential. It's going to be fun to see where it goes. But yes, the heart, there was a lot of heart to this last episode with the son. And I'm hoping that they are able to continue developing that relationship.
And hopefully this episode will have a lot of guts.
Yes, you
more balancing. So, we need some more violence now.
Right. More brains!
Speaking of heart and guts, another series that we should probably talk about is Terriers. And Noel, you caught up on Terriers this week, yeah?
Yes, I did. I haven't seen anything since, I think, the episode after when they kidnap Lindis and he gets conked on the head. So I watched everything up through last week's episode, and I mean, I've really, really liked the show a great deal. I'm not as crazy about it as everyone else is. I don't think it's the best thing to happen to television since, I guess, The Wire is the normal standard we use now. I didn't even think The Wire was the best thing to happen to television since
Woo!
The Wire.
You but, can definitely say that too.
Yeah.
You might get shamed.
I probably will get shamed.
Not by me, but I know who those people are, and I will warn you away from them.
I know who they are, too. But, no, I was really enjoying it. I definitely think that the show is Emmy-worthy for a lot of, especially for acting. I think Donald Logue is doing some really serious bang-up work in this show that it's almost hard to think that he was in the Tao of Steve. So, but no, I think it's a really good show.
Okay, hold on. I need you to tell me, what is this show and why should I watch it?
I think that while I was watching it, the thing that struck me most was the fact that they balance an episode-by-episode procedural with really well-thought-out arc stuff, which I really, really like, especially after dealing with Burr Notice's mishmash of handling those issues. They'll leave an arc alone for like two episodes and do a let's travel through San Diego and try to find a ring. Basically, was one episode, and it was actually probably one of the favorite episodes I watched was Ring a Ding Ding. I thought it was great, really entertaining, really fun. So I think there's that balance between the procedural and the arc stuff, but also just the relationship between Britt and Hank is just so good. I mean,
those are two detectives.
They're the two PIs. Yeah, Hank used to be a cop, but he got he was fired. And
so they have their own business that they do.
Right.
Okay.
And so they just take up odd jobs, and I have no idea how they make any money because I never see anyone get paid. But I never see Michael Weston get paid on Burr Notice either, so I have no idea. But I think one of the things that I really do like about the show is that unlike a lot of other FX's other shows, which is always white male in crisis mode, I really care about these white males in crisis as opposed to what happened on Nip/Tuck or, I've never really been able to get into Sons of Anarchy. I've tried multiple times. So, I mean, I'm really responding to the show, and I think a lot of it is chalked up to the performances that are just really, really solid. So I really like it and recommend it totally. I think you should catch up on it.
So what other shows that I may already be watching are like Terriers that would let me know this is my kind of show?
Oh, that is tough. I'm not sure that anything immediately springs to mind that I could compare Terriers to.
That becomes the question. Is that the problem?
That may be a bit of the problem. I mean, like, when I watched the pilot when it first started, I just went, oh, this is The Big Lebowski meets Veronica Mars. And it is. It still is. And I like both of those media products, for lack of a better term.
Right, but see, right there, you've just gotten my husband and I. Right there, that would be a show that we would each have a reason to watch. But maybe they should have marketed it that way. They should hire you, Noel.
Yeah, because everyone loved Veronica Mars so much.
I did. That's my point.
How could
you not? The Big Lebowski, which I hate. I love Veronica Mars, which he's never watched. But together, perhaps this could bring our marriage closer. See?
Your husband should watch Veronica Mars anyway. I'll have to yell at him the next time I see him. But yeah, Veronica Mars. That's just sad. But no, so I think like the thing that to compare it to is just because of the fact that it's too kind of schlubby characters is the Big Lebowski aspect of it, but the fact that it's also this really nice noir, neo-noir stuff feeds into that whole Veronica Mars feel as well. So I think it really works. I think that the fact that it's also about lower middle class people just doesn't appeal to people either, though I really, really like that aspect of it. So yeah, I think it's what do, Nick, you're all but through the most recent episode, what do you think?
I mean, I like it for the same reasons that you do. I love the chemistry between between Britt and Donald Logue's character. I think that that's half the reason why I watch it, for their teasers and their codas. They do some really well-written, well-thought-out episodes. I thought Missing Persons was a really well-thought-out episode.
Oh, that was really, really nicely done, I thought.
Yeah. with the kid from SVU that ended up being the killer at the end of last season. Did I spoil SVU for you guys? I apologize.
Damn it.
But yeah, I think that they do some really killer writing on the show. And even, Noel, you said you didn't like Ajo Caliente, but I really liked that episode. I thought it was good.
Is there pedigree here? Whose is the show? Who writes it?
It was created by the guy who wrote Ocean's 11. Sean Ryan's doing the show running on it. Tim Minear, who's done all the Joss Whedon shows.
Yay!
is an executive producer on the show, and he wrote this week's episode. And this week's episode is very, very good. So, Nick, you need to watch it.
Yeah. They were really pushing that on Twitter and online and stuff, trying to get more people that weren't watching the show to watch it, because it was like, look, a Tim Minear episode, and it seemed to garner a little bit more hype for the episode.
Except for the fact that anything Tim Minear works on immediately gets canceled.
He's the curse.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
I do plan to watch it. I don't know that it's popped up on my DVR yet, but I know that the other day I was looking for it, so I'll give it a go and see what it is. But I'm not a huge procedural person. So, although I'm watching The Good Wife, and that's sort of a procedural, but not.
I don't really feel that they're super comparable, just because of the heavy character serialization that's in The Good Wife, and I don't think that Terriers emphasizes the character serialization as much, because they don't overemphasize Hank's issues with Gretchen every single episode, which I really like.
Yeah.
It doesn't wear that story out, so by the time that the wedding occurs, it still feels fresh and raw as opposed to overplayed, which I really like.
Which, I mean, that might be a good thing to say about Terriers, is that it doesn't play out its arcs. It doesn't hammer
right
into us, like, say, Chuck does or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's another reason I think that the show probably could be doing better, is the fact that you could really jump in on any episode and be okay.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Which leads to, I was talking about this on Twitter earlier, but, I mean, the whole Save Terriers campaign, I think, is really, really fascinating in comparison to, say, the whole lack of the Save Rubicon campaign, where Terriers ratings are way worse. Well, not way worse, but they're worse than Rubicon's ratings were.
Are we talking like 200,000, 500,000? Something, right?
I actually have those, but I mean, like, I think, like, Terriers is drawing like a 0.5.
Okay.
And at least Rubicon is drawing a million.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, the ratings are all, you know, as all of us know, just complete and total bullshit.
Sure, sure.
But, I mean, there's this whole thing that I don't think that we'll see the type of justification for cancellation of Terriers being that the ratings didn't justify it. It was FX didn't give it a chance. Whereas when Rubicon gets canceled, it's, yeah, the ratings didn't justify getting a second season. And it's just like, what? That doesn't make any sense. Even Damages was doing better on FX than Terriers is doing, right?
Huh.
And it's totally different demographics, admittedly. But still, I mean, Damages was doing as well as, if not better than Terriers on most weeks. So,
right, but another interesting, you know, parallel here to go back to last week. Rubicon was sold pretty well. Like, what it was is what they sold it as. People just weren't interested, right?
Right.
And Lone Star was marketed terribly.
Oh,
people freaked out. And Terriers was marketed terribly. And people are upset. So it seems like they're getting annoyed when networks are not making it even possible. Like, it seems like they're setting up shows to fail because they don't get the show.
Oh, I think Terriers is just, I mean, I'm not even going to get into the fact that I think about the whole name thing being an issue, because I really don't think the name of the show is an issue. I mean, if people
did you see the promos before it started, though? There
yeah.
was a bunch of dogs yapping at you.
Yeah, no one had any idea what the show was about.
Right. And that, I think, was the issue. I mean, if people watch things called Bleep My Dad Says, I mean, I don't think the title of a show is necessarily something to get caught up in.
But that was a brand before the show started. That's the thing. People knew the Twitter account. People knew the book. That's a brand name before the show started.
That's
Terriers
true.
Isn't really anything.
And the actual advertisements did not tell you about the show.
Right.
You can give me a sense of what it was. And in fact, what they showed me, I mean, I thought it was the Dog Whisperer on crack.
That would be an interesting show, too.
You're right. That I might have tuned in for, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason why I tuned in was at first Sean Ryan's involvement, and then Donald Logue, who I mysteriously followed throughout his entire career, where I've watched things like Knights of Prosperity and
Grounded for Life.
Grounded for Life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that was the only reason why I started watching it, and I'm glad I did, especially because Britt is Renee from the first season of True Blood, which I didn't realize until I started watching it. And, yeah, and I love Renee. Renee's exit from the first season of True Blood is why I stopped watching True Blood, I think. So, yeah, I think it's a great show, and I think that people deserve to watch it. Is it worth saving? Not on ratings, but I think that as content piece it is. I agree with everybody that it's the best new series of this season. It's just sad that people didn't get to latch on, or people didn't know how to market it or whatever.
Well, then I think that if FX holds on a little bit and actually has a little patience here, I suspect Terriers will show up on enough top 20, top 10 lists at the end of the year. This is the season, right?
Yeah.
Maybe that'll help.
God willing.
Yeah.
So, moving on from Terriers, let's talk about some of the other big news from this week. NBC and Fox shuffled around their mid-season schedules, both in interesting fashions. Let's talk about NBC's first, and how about that three-hour comedy block on Thursday night? Is that going to work, do you guys think?
Yes, I love it.
Do you?
I think it's a great idea. Not so much just because it's 3 hours of comedy, and that's really the only big stuff that that network still has anymore. But
hey, it has Chuck.
Well, that's you guys. That's you guys. I don't watch Chuck.
No, it's literally me and Noel. I think we're the only ratings.
It might be, but it's especially the placement of things that I find to be the most interesting in it. Having Parks and Rec at 9:30, 30 Rock at 10, and Outsourced at 10:30. I think. Is the part of that that interests me the most, because you've got Parks and Rec coming back at 9:30, which, I mean, from last year, as much as I loved Community, and I still do love Community, I think Parks and Rec season 2 was the best thing that NBC had going for them last year. And it's a really highly anticipated return. And so it coming back and leading into 30 Rock, which is something that needs more people watching it, putting 30 Rock in between a very anticipated comeback as Parks and Rec and a very odd, I still don't understand why people are watching this show, like Outsourced, putting it in between those two, I think, is a really good move.
Except they, people like me that skip over Outsourced are a little worried that I'm going to miss the beginning or tail end of my shows, because I will purposely set my DVR to jump over it. But...
The bigger concern is if Outsourced ratings fall at 10:30 and people stop watching it, affiliates are going to howl about it, because all of a sudden usually they have a 10 o'clock drama that leads right into the news, and if Outsourced can't carry that 10:30 to 11 o'clock spot, affiliates are going to be way upset. I would say even more upset than they were about Leno.
Well, have they talked much about this?
I haven't seen a lot on it, and I mean, that's kind of the thing that I'm curious about with this. I mean, there was no uproar about the fact that they took 10 o'clock hour and made it into a comedy block as opposed to a network drama like there was when Leno took over for the entire week. It was the death of the network drama on NBC. And then it's just like, oh, okay, so we're going to put comedies there. Okay, that's fine, whatever.
It's scripted.
But I think the other thing is that, I mean, ever since ER went off the air, I mean, NBC hasn't known what to do with that 10 o'clock slot on Thursdays after their comedies. Anyway, because the Marriage Direct was there for a while, but The Apprentice has been there this season. So, I mean, I think that's why no one's really up in arms about there not being a network drama there. I think Parenthood would probably do really well there.
I do too.
But I'm intrigued by the whole three-hour comedy block. I just want Community to be okay.
I'm that way about Parks and Recreation. Getting Parks and Rec back on the schedule, because the whole problem with Outsourced is that, you know, we assumed it would fail because it's, you know, deeply offensive. but, of course, it didn't, because deeply offensive works. So when Outsourced did fine, that put Parks and Rec in real danger.
Yep, right.
Like, it could have just never come back. And so when I saw this news, all I thought was, thank God Parks and Rec has a place on the schedule. And maybe because of this wonderful thing of flow, where the people who aren't me are watching Outsourced, and maybe they won't be as obnoxious as I am, and they will actually take Parks and Rec or sit through Parks and Rec and discover that it's worthwhile. So, I mean, there's real potential to maybe boost some of these shows, and I just like the vote of confidence in the sitcom.
What do you guys think about NBC taking its comedies and putting it all in one night, putting all their eggs in one basket rather than sprinkling them out throughout the rest of the week?
I think Thursday night's always been a tough time, and what they're up against, especially now with the news, which we'll talk about next, allows them to really brand their night as being distinctive, unique, and if you're looking for laughs, if you're looking to just be entertained, we're going to give it to you.
Yep.
Right, and that's the same thing CBS did with its Monday lineup for the past couple of years when it did How I Met Your Mother, Big Bang Theory, and Rules of Engagement, and whatever else they had running on Mondays, was that Mondays was where you went to go laugh. And now ABC's got, CBS has Monday, ABC has Wednesday with their block, and now you've got Thursday for NBC, so Fox just needs their comedy block, which I don't think Fox is super interested in developing.
They're trying, because, I mean, they have Tuesdays with Glee and Raising
is
Hope.
Is Glee a comedy, though? Because I'm still not
Isn't it? Is it? What is Glee? Tell me, Noel. What is Glee? What is it?
I don't think it's a comedy. I think in, like Ally McBeal, it's a drama that just happens to have
How
a
dare case. You? How dare you? Are you really comparing Glee and Ally McBeal?
Generically, yes. They both had musical numbers. What more do you want from me?
And there's fantasy elements, too. Oh, no, you might be onto something here.
No. I can't wait for Rachel to see a dancing baby next season.
More likely the...
I literally am shedding a couple tears right now. So maybe Glee aside, but still, Raising Hope, comedy, big for them. Running Wild, they were hoping was going to be a comedy, and it turned out to not be. And then, but what are they replacing it with? What's coming on Tuesdays for Fox now? Because Running Wild, that's dead.
Well, it depends on which part of the calendar you're in. Glee does encore episodes beginning January 4th. From 8 to 9, and then they do the $1 million money drop. Very exciting. Yeah. And then in February, you get all new Glee episodes, followed by Raising Hope, followed by Mixed Signals.
Mixed Signals, that's it.
So.
And what is that?
I have no idea.
New ensemble comedy? Question mark? But yeah, so all the networks trying to have their own comedy nights, and Thursday has for the longest time belonged to NBC, so just extending it, when you have nothing else to put on there and you have all of these other comedies waiting in the wings, it's a good move. Because yes, like Karen said, it was looking like Parks and Rec might not have been coming back. With Community doing the way it is or isn't, depending on how you're looking at it, it's still very plausible the Community may not survive. And so putting everything out there instead of replacing stuff could do well for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be a fun experiment. You know, we get kind of set in these ideas of what this, you know, 8 o'clock hour should be versus what the 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock hour should be. And I understand that there's traditions and expectations, but I think it's kind of fun every once in a while to play with it. The move was more disappointing for people because, there was a whole host of other issues going on there. And here they're just kind of trying to extend something they do well. So I don't know. I don't think
they do well.
Well, fine. So maybe that's what they need to do. They're kind of in a holding pattern until they get the new team in from Comcast.
Right.
So exploit what you do well. See if it can play in the later hour. And, you know, what are the two shows that are on latest? You said it was 30 Rock and...
30 Rock and
Outsourced.
You know, 30 Rock is definitely the kind of show that attracts an older audience. So, you know, putting Outsource on that late, I actually think that's kind of strange. That's a show I would think you would get younger people and whatever else. You know, your more quote-unquote sophisticated comedies you might think would be really appropriate in that typical drama hour.
But that's why I'm thinking it's kind of a smart move, is because you put the shows that don't match that same demographic before it, so hopefully the Office and Parks and Rec crowd will continue watching, and they'll just be like, oh, well, what am I going to do for a half an hour? So they will watch 30 Rock to get to Outsourced. Maybe.
Yeah, you can help. So let's see what, I mean, I think it's a worthy experiment. Let's see what happens.
My only fear is that 30 Rock is the kind of show that can carry its audience. That people will watch 30 Rock no matter where it moves to. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that Outsource is going to be able to carry that audience, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's just that I have a biased opinion because I think Outsource is an abomination. So.
It's been able to build an audience against all expectations now, so maybe it'll be able to maintain it.
Yeah. So we mentioned a little bit about the Comcast teams coming in. What do you guys think about Greenblatt coming in to into this thing? Is that what NBC has been dying for? Somebody that knows scripted television?
Well, you know, following the executives, it was funny to read some of the write-ups. Like, there was one in Forbes. And, you know, if you read Forbes regularly, I suppose you know who all the executives are and what jobs they're in and what networks they've worked for. But I don't really follow it that closely. So when I look and see who these people are, I can say, okay, dude worked at Showtime. Okay, that means something to me.
Yep.
You know, I can look at their history. Oh, but that guy dated Chelsea Handler. He worked at E. Okay, you know, those are the associations I have. So the theme I took is they brought strong people from cable and are bringing them to network TV. And I, again, think that could be really interesting.
Yeah. Well, ABC did the same thing earlier when they brought in ABC Family's exec to take over after they ousted McPherson. So I think that's just the trend at this point. I'm worried about what will happen to the new NBC exec since he's inheriting what is clearly a mess, but that seems to be the status quo for NBC execs. You inherit a mess that Jeff Zucker somehow created, and then you just have to deal with it, and then get fired a year later.
I like how we're terming a lot of what NBC is doing as an interesting experiment for NBC. That's kind of what they have to do, interesting experiments, because everything else is just not working.
Except for 8, which stays exactly where it is.
Here's what I know. Number one, you know, as you just mentioned, Bob Greenblatt comes from Showtime. So he went in and was able to kind of turn around Showtime and really make it a name in quality TV, like cable, primetime cable, HBO style, you know, television. Right. And then you have, as I just mentioned, Ted Harbert. He's the one that worked at E! And dated Chelsea Handler. So when you talk about Chelsea Handler and you talk about E!'s kind of lowest common denominator kind of TV, like exploitation, celebrity nonsense, all the things that E! Does, so you take that Showtime quality and you combine it with E! Exploitation, and, you know, you might end up somewhere in the middle that could be fascinating. Or, you know, I think there's just potential there to... The part of the problem with NBC has been safe, has been reworking the same old thing. There hasn't been a lot of daring going on at NBC. So at least here we have kind of some extremes of what kind of television we can have. And maybe when we put them together, we'll get some sparks.
God willing. What about the schedule reshuffling that's going on with, like, Parenthood moving to Monday night?
And then to Tuesday night.
Is it moving twice?
Yes.
It's moving to Monday and then back to Tuesday?
Yes.
Oh, why? That's sad for it.
So really Parenthood, beginning January 4th, runs on Tuesdays at 10 for 4 episodes, and then goes to Monday nights.
That's not good.
No, it's not.
Why don't they know that? Moving shows around is bad.
Oh, we'll get to moving shows around so Matt can cry in a minute.
I don't want to talk about it.
But
the thing about Parenthood is that it is a very... I know a lot of its numbers come from DVR. It's consistently one of the most DVR'd network shows every week. So maybe they're thinking, moving it around, not many people watch it live. We'll just move it around as we see fit, and people will just have to change their recordings and watch it whenever they feel anyway.
I don't know. When I see a show move like that, what it tells me is they don't have a ton of confidence in it. And so it's like throwing the spaghetti against the wall to see what sticks. So they're just kind of desperate, and they're just going to move it and say, here, we'll try it here. Oh, okay, we'll try it here. But they're not really thinking about the show. They're not really thinking about how they can best market it, sell. I mean, because there's just no logic behind it. An audience needs to get accustomed to where a show is. TV, for most people, is a routine. Yep. It's how they know it's Tuesday. So because certain shows are on. And I don't think executives are not aware that they are in some ways really defying the odds here. This is their way to pretend that they're trying, but in fact, I think they're kind of saying goodbye to Parenthood. It's a real I take it as a bad sign.
But how, with a show like that, I don't understand how they're doing everything they can to get people to watch Chase, but Parenthood is being thrown under the bus.
Yeah, I don't know how expensive Parenthood is either. You know, when you have that many kind of well-known TV actors, you know, is it kind of like the expectation? It just has to do better than it's doing because it's more costly. I don't know.
But then again, they also it's always started at 10. So if you had this more expensive show because of its actors or whatever, why not? Why would you put it so late anyway? Why wouldn't you put it in a more in a better time slot to showcase the people that you have, to showcase the talent? And I mean, even the, not that most audiences necessarily pay attention, but look at the people behind it. Jason Kadams and Lawrence Trillian, like, for industry people, these are well-known, you know, well-known names behind the scenes too. So for all of that, why not try and push this show better? Slapping it at 10 o'clock from the get-go already seemed like they didn't really know what to do with it from the beginning.
Parenthood, content-wise, isn't really a 10 o'clock show anyway.
No.
It could move to like a 9 o'clock where they could get better advertising.
It's a pickle.
It's a pickle. Now, Fox also had a mid-season reshuffle. It's obviously January is going to be all American Idol all the time. That's what they do. I don't know how people watch that show like and keep up with it. I'm exhausted like watching like.
What season is this now? I've lost track. What season are we going into
this,
now?
This will be 47.
Oh, okay.
Do you watch it?
I stopped watching after about 33. I lost. I lost count.
And Nick.
Yeah.
Do you watch it?
It'll be its 9th, 10th season, I think. It'll be season 10. Season 9? Hang on.
I'm just going to be honest. I want to see what Steven Tyler is like on American Idol, so I will probably watch that first episode.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of have to, just to see where they're going to go with that show. And, like, and I heard that they were going to, like, cut straight to, like, the bottom 12, like, really quick, but now they're not going to do that anymore, but...
Hey, I read that they were going to have challenges, like they had to like dance to their songs or so. I don't know. I
thought you meant like Double Dare, like physical challenges.
Is Double Dare the one where they had like the slime fall on them?
That's
every Nickelodeon show pretty much. But yeah, that they did feature lots of
slime. That could really help. That could be a good idea.
See, but we shouldn't be giving good ideas to American Idol because call me a conspiracy theorist or call me whatever. This is the beginning of the end for Community.
Is it?
Going up against Big Bang Theory and American Idol, I think, is going to be the end.
I mean, I'm concerned about Community just because I'm convinced that NBC may like Community, but I'm also convinced that they also don't get any of the back end from Community, so they're looking to replace it with something that they can get the back end out of. But I think that Community's audience is Community's audience, and they're not going to watch American Idol.
I don't know, but listen to us right here. We're like, oh man, Steven Tyler, that could be kind of cool. Challenges, what? So like, we're doing all of these other things instead of, you know, we're already talking about watching American Idol for various random reasons instead of tuning into Community.
Right, but so, we're watching it because we think it's going to be a car wreck. I'm going to keep watching Community because it's good.
Right, but if enough people will watch American Idol to check it out, to see what's going on or what have you, that's still taking away from it. And some people might get kind of stuck. Some people might say, oh, well, American Idol is on. Because I know a lot of people have this mentality with television. Community is half an hour long. American Idol is, it's an hour, isn't it?
Hour and a half hours, now. It made it 90
hour
minutes.
And half. Wow, okay. So I'll DVR Community because it's shorter, and I'll watch American Idol because... it's longer, and I can always just come back and watch Community later. So it's little things like that that might start embedding themselves in people's thinking and their television viewing that could spell certain doom for Community.
People that actually watch American Idol live as it airs, that's an audience I cannot comprehend because that show has more filler. I mean, how you would ever like choose to watch American Idol over something that's tight and compact like Community did. There's just no logic to it. So
it's just people that are obsessed with crying montages. I mean, watching American Idol is one of the saddest things I've ever done because there's just so many people just crying and just with terrible music underneath it, and then just montages just dissolves into more people crying. I don't know how people can watch that. It's like schadenfreude.
I get the appeal of American Idol. I've watched a few seasons and I still think it's awesome that Kelly Clarkson won the first season, you know, that the person with a lot of real talent won and went on to do well. And we do have this whole, you know, it's a weird version of the American dream, but it's still a version of the American dream, you know, that I think actually people really, it really resonates for them. But that said, I think I agree with Noel that Community's audience is not American Idol's audience. And so I would be surprised, maybe the first week or two, we might see a little shift, but I'd be very shocked if American Idol really had a lot of impact on Community. It'd be more like The Office that I'd be worried about, to
I'm just scared. I'm looking over my shoulder for every conceivable reason why Community is going to get canceled.
You want to know a reason why Community is going to get canceled? Perhaps the fact that its creator likes to pick fights. Doing it with people.
He's amazing for that. I love Dan Harmon so much.
He's doing it at NBC. How do they feel about him?
Well, they have no sense of humor because look at their NBC Thursday night lineup. But they should. I mean, that's something. And again, those are the kind of things that make his fan base so loyal, is because I want to tune in and see if he's going to knock Glee this week again.
No, he's an interesting personality, certainly. But, I mean, I do think he sometimes picks fights with people who are on his side.
Yeah,
and
he
if he's doing that with, you know, the people, the critics and whatever,
yeah.
I wonder if he maybe does that with the people that work with him.
Yeah,
so there's all kinds of reasons
of
that show.
Complaints are poop-faced jokes, so, I mean, you can't really take too much offense to that.
Perhaps. If you're an executive, you might.
So, Matt, do you want to... I feel like that we're going to do a weekly sadness for some kind of cancellation or scheduling change. Matt,
it seems like it. Noel had Rubicon last week, and now I have Fringe. I had been very complacent with the fact that, okay, Community, things don't look good, but there aren't all of these petitions out there for saving Community like there are with Life Unexpected and Terriers and things like that. So I was like, okay, maybe for once I'll have a show.
Wait. There's petitions to save Life Unexpected?
Oh, yes.
Are you kidding?
Life
really?
Unexpected? Yes.
Do you have Twitter? It seems like every third thing in my feed is someone saying something about Life Unexpected. There's a
the
huge...
The only person who watches Life
Unexpected... You weren't following anyone that I follow then.
Yeah.
you need to watch for that luck shovel.
Yeah, but so anyway, I was finally thinking, all right, maybe I'll have a season where something that I love doesn't get canceled, but the move for Fringe to Fridays is, like, that. It's the end now.
I have a real issue with this whole Friday thing. I get some of the reasons why people say it's a graveyard, and I know that, in theory, people go out. I suppose those are people who aren't like me. I hardly ever go out on a Friday, so I'm happy to have some good TV on. Blue Bloods is doing okay there, right? So they put a show with a big-time TV actor, and that show's doing okay. I mean, Friday has not historically been the death place that it is now, and so, you know, maybe that the show there doesn't have the same expectations. Like, it might be okay that Fringe has its loyal following if they follow it there. Its numbers won't have the same expectations for big numbers that they have where it is now.
True. It depends on the demographic. Blue Bloods, CBS, LOL, old people. Smallville and Supernatural do well because a lot of their demographics are teenagers who can't necessarily go out on Friday night, so they'll stay home and they'll watch their pretty people doing, you know, crazy things on the CW on Friday night. But Fringe shares so much of its fan base with Lost, and a lot of those people tend to be, you know, like people in their 20s and 30s and
Have lives.
Oh, yeah, okay, if you want to put it that way, sure. So it's harder, you know, to keep a show like that on Friday because a lot of its viewers are going to be doing other things. And no matter how much you love a show, I love Smallville to death. And I go out, you know, a lot of Fridays, and I won't watch Smallville until Saturday or Sunday. And I hate that I'm going to have to choose between doing this with Fringe, but that's what it comes down to. And most people that aren't as, you know, in love with television as we are would rather choose going out than watching TV on a Friday. So unless you're someone who, for whatever reason, has to stay in on Friday, most of the time, Friday shows aren't going to get seen. And so moving Fringe, not only that, but in all of this Fringe to Friday news, I've heard that putting it up against it being up against Supernatural was always something that hurt it before Supernatural's move, and now it's going up against Supernatural again. And so competing with a show that was beating it in its time slot before is not good for it either.
Okay, you're right. That point is very well taken. That the two similar genre-based sci-fi, you know, cult kind of shows head-to-head on a Friday, you're right. That's kind of dangerous, especially since, you know, my argument with the CW is that they don't mind alternative viewing mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't mind that their shows get downloaded or otherwise, as long as it's legal and through their website. But maybe Fringe won't have that kind of mindset behind it. So, if I was a Fringe fan, I would be as upset as you are. I hear what you're saying.
Very upset. But I just, and I had said this when Noel and I were talking about it before, I hope that right now they're going, okay, this is looking really bad. Let's think about how we might possibly be able to end this show. I don't know if it's too early or if it's too late, but I'm hoping that they're already thinking about that because it's not looking good.
Do they still have Alt Olivia in, like, the real world right now?
Oh, yeah, that's still going on, so...
Oh, yeah, that's a big mess there they'd have to clean up.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a lot to have to try and solve, you know, by the beginning of next summer.
But... Fringe is a show that I started and I liked, and, you know, I follow Pacey. He's one of my guys that I'll follow. I wasn't thrilled with Anna Torv. I wasn't, you know, didn't dislike her. Wasn't like, you know, she wasn't as terrible as like the Bionic Woman actress was.
Oh man!
But it just didn't hold me enough, and so I fell off of it. And then suddenly, Fringe is one of those shows that seems to get better and better. Like its second season, it grew a lot, and now they say this is its best season ever. So
it is, absolutely. I was a sucker for the intense advertising that they were doing for that show when it first started. It was all over the place, and I watched it and stopped. It was too episodic. Oh. It was too procedural. But
you
then it really ditches that style and becomes... Actually, a lot of what Noel was saying about Terriers... I could say about Fringe. It does a good job of balancing its arcs, having, you know, to an extent, week-to-week, quote-unquote, adventures, but it still ties into the, you know, episodic arcs or seasonal-long arcs. It still has to do with bigger-picture things, and so it changing that style, I think, really helped the show, but that news about what it did didn't get out there necessarily that much because still not a lot of people are watching it. And I absolutely believe now that I've caught up, gave it another chance and everything like that, it is the best show that people aren't watching right now.
That's a fascinating thing too. Like shows that do get better when networks do support it and let them grow. Is there any strategy that has proven effective to try and get a new audience to check into a show that's already in process?
Canceling it and putting it on Adult Swim. That's about it.
Yeah. Network shift. That's interesting. I mean, they don't seem to know how to take a show like Fringe and grow its audience. It's kind of fascinating. It's a real dilemma.
So I'm interested to see what, network shift as a potential, you know, as a real potential savior, because I know there's a big movement for Life Unexpected to move to ABC Family. There's a big movement for Fringe to move to Sci-Fi. I wonder if of course these are like last-ditch efforts for people trying to save their show, thinking it can go somewhere else, but is that a really plausible idea?
Fringe going to Sci-Fi makes a lot of sense.
But the thing of it is Fringe, one of the problems that people say there is with Fringe is that it costs a lot to produce an episode of that show, and it doesn't pull in its ratings. Moving to Sci-Fi shows, I mean, they don't have, I don't know if Fringe's budget would survive on Sci-Fi either, unless it could pull in numbers that, you know, Battlestar Galactica did or things mm-hmm. like that, because realistically that's the only recent sci-fi show to survive and do well on anywhere on television. I mean, Lost, you can say, okay, yes, it's sci-fi, but even if you look at it, when it became a lot more sci-fi, it lost a hell of a lot of its viewers.
Yeah, it's true.
So it's frustrating to think that there's no place for good sci-fi on television.
Hmm.
I'm still crying over Firefly. That's where some of this is coming from.
Aw, I'm sorry.
Time to let me go, man.
Oh, man, did it? I don't remember. I can't remember.
Fox likes to move stuff to Friday nights anyway, right before it gets canceled.
But, I mean, look at Dollhouse. Just happened with Dollhouse.
So. Well, Dollhouse started out on Fridays. So.
Yeah, it did. But, I mean, just the sci-fi on Fox on Friday, that's not those...
Dark Angel.
Dollhouse
had a lot of issues. I'm not sure Dollhouse had the same kind of strong core that Fringe does.
No, not at all. It didn't. And I mean, I liked Dollhouse, but I'm nowhere near upset about Dollhouse's cancellation.
They gave it every opportunity
possible right now.
So, moving right along from the Fringe thing, to shows that probably have no chance of ever being canceled. Let's talk about Food Network Television or Food on TV. You guys
want to
talk about that for a second?
Did you watch the finale for Top Chef Just Desserts, Karen?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I didn't really like Just Desserts for the first couple of episodes. I felt it was really dull. And then suddenly, all their personalities just started to blossom and go insane.
So the rumor is that a bunch of the people on Just Desserts are trying to get their own reality shows, and that that's some of why we had such, you know, nutballs. You know, bouncing off the walls there.
The Red Hot Pepper for My Mommy is the new battle cry of any reality show.
Yeah, Seth, I mean, Seth was uncomfortable entertainment, but it was still entertainment. I mean, it would have been more fun if we had gotten a little more behind the scenes. Like, hearing Gail Simmons talk about that situation would have been a riot.
Was what was actually really interesting to me, was the fact that they basically broke the wall of reality television, if we can conceptualize that, to show the producers on screen talking about the challenge and then talking to the contestants about what Seth was doing. I mean, anytime something like that has happened before, it's been like when Marcel was semi-assaulted in season 2 of Top Chef, Colicchio came and talked to them, not the producers.
Mm.
And so I really feel like they kind of broke a wall there by showing us them waiting in the steer room to set for the prep for the quickfire, and then having the producers come in and talk about what just happened with Seth being carted off, basically.
So you felt like we had a little bit of reality in our reality TV, like, shockingly.
But that still ended up being part of the overall reality. I'm doing air quotes with reality.
Yes, me too.
The only thing I might be able to say here is
with the reality narrative that they're constructing in the competition. So I think that was really interesting. I really found that interesting. And Seth's whole thing, I think, really just kind of spurred the show on for me. But as for the finale, though, I mean, I was thrilled Morgan didn't win. I'm not going to lie. But I'll let you talk about it for a little bit.
You didn't like his personality.
No, and I think that's one of the things that I get really conflicted about with, especially with Top Chef, because I talked about this with a few folks with Top Chef last season, was we can't taste the food. So we have no idea how their cooking is. The entire thing with these cooking shows is that we basically end up rooting for people whose personalities we like.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. No matter how much he told me Danielle's food was good, Johnny seemed to really like Danielle and be happy with her work, I just don't believe him. There's just no way her food is that good. It was messy. It was never very professionally done. I just don't buy that she made it to the finals. I think everything about it was a scam. And he worked really hard to tell me her food was good, and I don't get it. So, yeah, not being able to try the food, you're right. We depend a lot on liking these people.
Right. And I think that's okay. I mean, I, for one, just, if Danielle had gone off and wasn't, like, in the last few episodes, I probably would have stopped watching, just because I found her so entertaining.
Really?
Oh, I think she was just so quirky and crazy and cartoony weird that it was just so much fun. I mean, her idea of doing Conan O'Brien and Andy Richter as her celebrity power couple was great, I thought. That entire episode was bizarre anyway, but...
I like funny, cute, weird, like Carla and her hootie-hoo and whatever.
Yeah.
I don't like kind of bitchy. Like, Danielle would talk about people behind their backs, which is, and I don't like when anybody does that. It just makes them seem less interesting to me. So, you know, I think they were, this particular show had a couple of challenges. One of the things we learned is that pastry chefs have a real chip on their shoulder.
Yes.
And that chip manifests in all kinds of ways. And so it attracts particular personalities. And even though you could maybe get the underdog like the baker, who just kind of insists that he can make it through, you know, the fact that the baker was so different from all of these really high-strung, uptight pastry chefs.
Right. Really elitist.
Any version of this show is going to have that kind of personality type. And if you weren't into it, if you didn't like all of the kind of, like, you know, very gay, bitchy talk, and then the really kind of nasty, you know, hetero, you know, alpha man versus, you know, that would be, and then we got a lot of disgruntled women, and everybody was unhappy a lot,
yeah,
all the time, and really felt like they were always, like, talking to someone who was attacking them. If you aren't into that, if you can't find entertainment there, this is never going to be the show for you.
I think you're right, and I think getting back to your idea about the whole... idea of how the show conceptualizes or tells us to conceptualize Pastry Chefs. What was really interesting was with when the finale, when that major pastry chef describes Morgan as a typical male pastry chef.
Mm-hmm.
I just went, oh, wow, so it's not just Morgan being a jackass.
Yep.
Male pastry chefs are like that. Ooh, that's that was really interesting.
Yeah, and the best part of the show for me was every time Johnny would come out in the hallway after he talked to the chefs while they were doing their work, he would tell us what he thought. And I would love to see, like, I think the other challenge for this show is that pastry work, baking, is very different from cooking. You know, it's very precise.
Right.
And there isn't, you know, when you make a mistake, it's really hard to fix it, unlike cooking, where there's a lot of different things you can do. And so, you know, chocolate looks like chocolate looks like chocolate looks like chocolate. You know, you don't have, like, seven different proteins that you're working with that can really make things more interesting. I found the food difficult to identify with and recognize and differentiate.
Right.
I'm not a pastry chef. It's an expertise that's beyond me. So having Johnny talk to me a little bit helped me to understand better what was going on in that room. And if I would have loved to have seen even more of that because, you know, having the show be a little more educative maybe could have helped me appreciate some of the technique that Danielle was showing that I just could not see through her personality.
Right. I'm with you there. I think that that's one thing I've always liked about Top Chef anyway, is when the head judge, whether it be Johnny or Calicchio on regular Top Chef, talks to us about what's going on, I think is really helpful sometimes.
Yeah.
And really interesting, especially since these are two people who know what they're talking about and can guide us through it, regardless of whether or not we consider ourselves a foodie or not, because clearly Top Chef is aiming for that demographic. I think you kind of need that kind of guide through pastry land or through seven protein land. I think you're right. I think the show would have benefited from that. I think I would have liked to have more Gail as well, but that's just because Gail's so pretty. I'm curious to see what they can do to change up in season two.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure. I mean, I liked the idea of doing pastry shop wars, but I don't really feel like that idea was developed very well for that episode. So I'll be curious to see what they expand on for... I'm assuming they're doing a season two. But, so...
Oh, yeah, I do too. I don't know what its ratings were like, but yeah. I
imagine we'll get to one eventually, but just because that's their big Emmy bait brand now.
Yeah.
So speaking of Emmy bait, Top Chef All-Stars. I am, like, so excited about Top Chef All-Stars. I really didn't care for the last season of Top Chef. It felt dry, it felt stale, the contestants were just kind of dull.
There were lots of problems.
So when they announced All-Stars, I was really excited, because I was just like, okay, I know these people already, they've got established things, I know these people can cook, and then I saw the rundown of everyone that was going to be in it, and then I just got even more excited.
So here's the concern. When you talk about Top Chef DC, part of and I wrote about this a bit for the site. So
right, I remember.
Is that I felt like the producers and the judges were setting the chefs up not to succeed.
Right.
They were things about the challenges that were convoluted and manipulative and did not help the good chefs do a good job. And it added a certain sort of drama, but it was a drama not actually based in, like, the stuff that I enjoy, which is watching people struggle and achieve and, you know, feel pressure and have to overcome it. Those kind of typical, like, things I would watch as an athlete go through.
Absolutely.
So if we see any of that with Top Chef All-Stars, it's going to be particularly problematic because, interestingly, this is a show where virtually everyone on it is a fan favorite.
Right.
So if they pull that stuff with these people, you are really going to have some outrage. And I'm hoping that they're going to know that the personalities here are why we're going to tune in, and we don't need them messing with the challenges. Let these great chefs, who we all know these people are all good in some way, do what they do and show us what they've got.
Right, like Spike's the only one that didn't really like get as far into the competition as the rest of his peers did.
But he's super likable.
Exactly, and that's why they probably brought him in. So,
and he's also down home. I went to his burger place in D.C., and, like, the guy just wanted to make some greasy burgers and serve them in some paper and, you know, have some thick shakes. Like, there's something real down-to-earth about him that
right.
You probably need with all of these, you know, micro, what is it called?
Microgastronomist.
A microgastronomist. You kind of need a few people like Fabio, who just brings it back down to earth. And
right. So who are you rooting for in Top Chef All-Stars then? Who's your horse in that race?
Richard.
Richard. Okay. Cool. Cool.
But like I said, I really like Carla. I don't know, what's his name? Our other Atlanta guy on there?
No, Kevin Gillespie is not in this, which made me really sad.
That's okay, because I want to see Richard. Richard was a nice guy. He was very gifted. So I'm actually just going to, some of these people I may not know from earlier seasons. And
when did you start watching? Did you start watching in season 4 with Richard Blaze?
No, I think it was 3.
Okay.
I watched Hong. Which year was that?
That was season 3, because I was with Casey, and that's who I'm rooting for, actually, is Casey.
Oh, no, I really liked Hong. I'm glad he won. So, yeah, it'll be good. I'm excited about it, too. I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk about whether they screw it up or not.
Okay. Oh, yes, we will. No worries. So with that, I think we can probably move into, this last little roundup. I really would like, if Karen's willing, to talk a little bit about Private Practice a bit. I've been really loving your pieces on Private Practice, even though I haven't watched the show, and I still haven't watched those episodes. So I'd love to hear you talk about just kind of sum up basically this arc that's been going on, as well as your responses to it, because I've been talking to anyone on Twitter about who's referenced the Private Practice thing. Quite a few people have, and complimented you, because I really think that those articles you're doing are really, really important articles. And I've really enjoyed reading them, but so I'd really just like for you to maybe talk a bit more about it here for us, if you're willing, of course.
Well, sure, yeah, but high praise, dude. Thanks. That's a little intimidating. Private Practice is a tricky show, and one of the things I did in the review for last week was kind of try to acknowledge that. Basically, it's a show about doctors, same people that do Grey's Anatomy, and so one of the characters 2 weeks ago was attacked and raped, and she's like the chief of staff at the hospital. She's real uptight and kind of bitchy. She's just a tough gal, but the point is the woman that was most emotionally kind of wrapped up has this horrible thing happen to her. So Shonda Rhimes wanted to kind of follow that through this character. And one of the explicit goals that she stated before, because they made it very clear, they used this storyline to attract a wider audience. The critics were writing about it weeks before, saying this is the upcoming storyline. There were photos released of the actress in the scenes in the hospital afterwards, so you could see that she was all beat up in her face, and so it was never meant to be a surprise. This attack, they really wanted it to be something that would get the audience watching. So I suppose you could say there was an implicit exploitive element to it.
Right, but I mean, rape films in the past tend to be like that. I mean, those are big draws. There's that sense of exploitation even with those Lifetime original movies that would focus on something like that. So I think that she's still operating within a marketing melodrama type of brand there. So
focusing on a woman's story, that's one of the things I think she was very aware of. She wanted to do this a little differently, in that she really wanted to focus on the woman's experience and not kind of the legal system. I think she feels like normally the storyline gets told and we learn an awful lot about the detectives and what they're trying to do, or the lawyers, or any of that kind of stuff. And so she wanted it to be more about the character.
Okay.
And she's sort of doing that, but increasingly I'm becoming more concerned. The first week I largely was trying to respond to a few critics and kind of say, I don't think one of the claims made by Emily Nussbaum was that maybe television shouldn't tell these stories, that maybe it's impossible to depict a rape on TV and have it not be in some way exploitative, have it not be in some way appealing to the prurient interest we may naturally have in sex or anything, that even violence. And so she was very kind of felt like there was just not no way to do this well, even though they tried. And then in the week 2, I started to kind of see how the storyline was basically, how does this rape affect everyone else around also? Mm-hmm. Not just the woman, but also the people around her. And I I ended up deciding that it was very characteristic of the program, which is a problematic program. Like, the characters were very true to form. But still, they allowed the actress to kind of try to play things out on her terms. And one of the things that's been important to me is to kind of see how a survivor is able to reclaim control over her life. So largely, that's one of the things that's taken away. So one of the important things to understand about where I'm coming from here is that I think that, and this might become, you know, more controversial as it goes on, is that I'm very suspicious of the justice system.
No. I mean, I think this, I mean, everything informs everyone's opinions about how they receive media. So, I mean, I think you're on fine ground here with that idea. So continue. Sorry.
Yeah. We'll see how long I keep writing about it. But the problem for me currently that I'm working through, especially with the episode I just watched, is that we have a certain faith that what a victim of any attack should do is go to the police, let the police do their thing, and that in part will help. If it doesn't necessarily help you immediately, it will help long term, it'll save other people from being attacked, whatever else. That this is something that, the word that kept coming up, the phrase that kept coming up in the most recent episode was the right thing. What is the right thing? How do we do it? How do we determine it? If there's fallout from doing the right thing, what does that mean? And I like that question, but I think the show still has a certain need to find a right thing. And right now they're putting their trust in the police. Get this guy behind bars. They were all very insistent this week that she had to go in and she had to identify him and she had to admit that the attack had happened in the first place and all of these things. And I'm much more interested in the stuff that Shonda Rhimes talked about originally, which is, how does this woman rebuild her life? How does she rebuild her relationship? How does she feel about her work at the hospital? I would love to see her kind of have a new awareness for victims' rights, to maybe start some new initiatives at the hospital to really, you know, to hire some particular, there's something called a SANE nurse, someone trained specifically for assault victims. You know, I'd like to see this show take kind of a broader sociological stance. And I think that I'm not against melodrama. I think melodrama can be used really well, but I need it to be used in tandem with a certain sense of responsibility.
Right.
Anyway, that's all long-winded. But I think what I'm excited about is that Shonda Rhimes is aware of some of the questions and the challenges, and so she's trying to face them head on. And I'm not sure she's always succeeding, but I'm deeply engaged in the storyline. So,
well, I hope you keep writing about it. If you, of course, have time and everything.
Sure.
With that, go to No Ordinary Family, Matt. Judging from the promos this week, No Ordinary Family seemed like it had a big week in terms of its stories with, I can only think of him as Maxie. Michael Chiklis, his character, was he ID'd by the guy who shot him? Or what was going on there and what's been leading up to that?
He was. So in all of Michael Chiklis' character Jim and Romany Malco's character George, in all of their vigilanteism, it was only a matter of time until Jim got spotted by someone. And so this week we had a story where George was going after this mobster, and in an altercation with Jim, he saw Jim's face. And so this was a very Romany Malco-centric episode where George had to decide between putting this mobster who he'd been after for years behind bars and protecting Jim's identity. And it brought him as a supporting character into light a lot more, talked a lot about the importance of him to Jim's crime fighting, not only, but also to the family. And I was very impressed with the episode, not only from that standpoint, but we also had Katie play a much bigger role as a supporting character in this one too, taking on a tutoring role to JJ in his super genius, and also getting tied in. She is now dating, apparently, the Watcher, who is Evil Camden's psychic right hand friend. So a lot of supporting cast coming into play a lot more, getting tied up into the family and the seasonal arc, which we keep getting a little bit more and more of every episode, and I'm really excited to see where this is going to lead into.
I only watched a few episodes of it, but it didn't give me those little bits fast enough. so I stopped. Do you really, think
even,
is that
even in the end of the pilot when we learn that Evil Camden is indeed evil and knows about people with abilities and stuff?
Yeah, I guess I needed more of his goal. I didn't feel like the bad guys were clear enough to me, so mostly it was about the family. It was like the superhero stuff was just tacked on, but really it was just a family drama. And I don't know. I tried 3 episodes, I think. So I gave it a good go there, yeah. But it just didn't get me.
The show is definitely more of a family drama, but they are very slowly starting to incorporate more of their abilities and this mythology that they're trying to create. The end game is still not necessarily clear for Evil Camden, but we are starting to learn more about how he's involved in everything, and there's this mysterious researcher who had been doing research into people with abilities before, who he has kind of seemingly picked up. His name was Dr. Volson. He has seemingly picked up Volson's research and is modifying it, continuing it for yet unexplained nefarious means. But it is taking a little bit to get there, but they keep reminding us, hey, don't forget this guy is evil. We're going to come back to it eventually. And I'm hoping for a big payoff. I know every time I talk about it, I always compare, but I'm hoping the payoff will be more than we ever got with any episode of Heroes.
Yeah, I mean, Heroes, I was never a fan ever and watched it begrudgingly, and then eventually finally was able to give it up in season 2 or something like that. But the other concern for me with No Ordinary Family was, it was kind of fascinating, the mother character, had this high-powered career. She was making most of the bacon for the family and whatever, and yet she also just seemed to do all of the cleaning, all of the primary mothering and lunch making and all of that kind of stuff.
She was getting ready for the zombie apocalypse.
I know. I was just kind of uncomfortable. Like, because it was focused on the family, they still did it along largely ideological lines that make me a little uncomfortable. And in a show about superheroes, I had this concerns with The Incredibles too. So this is just an issue I have. And I kind of, part of what I want to see when I see people being extraordinary is to break out of the typical things I expect. And this show doesn't want to do that. So,
well, maybe the cape will. Fingers crossed.
There you go.
Do you have a lot of faith in the cape?
No.
Okay, because you sounded really optimistic and I didn't want to tear you. I mean, I'm somewhat looking forward to it. I want to see, it's hard, again, as with sci-fi, it feels like it's hard to have good superhero shows on television, and the cape, I don't know if it's going to be the savior that we're looking for.
It won't.
Well, it'll probably be the new Hulk television series that's coming out.
That's going to save us all.
Well, let's all try it, and then we can have a nice, fun bitch session after its first episode.
Gladly.
Well, I think to close this out, Karen, you wanted to say a couple of words about In Treatment this season, which, judging from my Twitter feed, has been actually pretty good. I tried watching a couple episodes in the first season and decided that if I wanted to sit in on someone else's therapy, I would have just recorded my own sessions. So I'd be curious for your thoughts on this to close this out.
Okay, I watched season 1. I've watched all the seasons. I was very suspicious during season 1. I really wasn't sure what it was. I stuck with it through the first few weeks. Was not convinced. It's very theatrical. It's just two people in a room having a conversation.
It's a bottle show.
Yeah, it fascinated me, but also kind of alienated me. But it's one of those shows, it's a cable show, right? Eventually, the payoff is huge. It allows wonderful actors to do wonderful performances. There's usually one or two of the characters that I just really get excited about, and the others I kind of am okay with. And then eventually, they usually get more interesting, too. The main character is extremely problematic, as is typical of cable shows focusing on male characters. So it's got some of those things that everyone's used to. But it's. I loved the article a few weeks ago about slow TV that was talking about Rubicon. I think that was the guy at the Hollywood Reporter that was talking about that. It's definitely slow TV. It's only a half hour each episode. Actually, they tend to be about 20 minutes, but it's 4 episodes a week. So it's a different kind of model.
Right.
They initially tried to do 1 episode a day, which I actually like that model best. Because it was so short, it could just be that you could watch a little bit of it here or there, or you could splurge at the end of the week with it. But So they've always been experimenting, trying to find the right model. But if you like good actors doing good work, it's a great show. If you really enjoy kind of exploring a character's psyche and seeing characters in crises, it's an excellent show. And then the kind of long-term through line is that the main character, who's a therapist, is himself in therapy. And he's got Amy Ryan as his therapist this year, and she's doing excellent work. So if you like her on The Office and you want to see her doing something radically different, you should definitely check her out. It's the fourth episode every week. And like I said, it's a short 20, 25 minutes. But she and Paul are having incredible conversations. It is a duel of masters. And I find a lot of excitement there, despite the fact that it's slow TV. So I just wanted to give it a plug because it has terrible ratings. This show really is down at the 250,000 level. It's no one's watching it. But I think that if people do, they will find that it does pay off in the end. So
probably Gabriel Byrne's best work since Hello Again.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing a wonderful job. I mean, he's exciting to watch. And he's also getting older, and it's kind of fun to watch an actor getting older. You know, I get to watch him every year, and he's having a great time with it. So, thumbs up.
So that kind of wraps everything up here for the Monsters TV broadcast. Hope that you enjoyed it. We certainly did, as much as we talked over each other. And anything else to tag at the end?
Please watch Community and Fringe, both of them. Thursdays at 8 and Thursdays at 9, soon to be Fridays at 9. But please, I'm going to go on ahead and plug my shows that are dying. Please watch Community and Fringe. Please, I beg you, please.
That could be a new feature. Once a week, we will let somebody just beg for people to watch a show.
We've been doing it the past 2 weeks. I'm hoping we're not going to have to do it again, but if so, Karen or Nick, it's you guys' turn, okay?
There you go.
Chuck will never die.
Anyway, no, apparently, you can't kill it.
You can't kill Chuck. Unstoppable. It's like the train.
All right, thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you, guys. And we'll see you next week.